I want to ask you first about this idea of immigration affecting native-born workers. There is a feeling that if people come from elsewhere, that it is going to naturally negatively impact the availability of jobs for native-born Americans. Talk a bit more through the research that you've done about that and that you've seen about that.
This is a natural reaction, which is, you know, you observe a foreign-born worker coming in and taking a job, and your natural reaction is, oh, you know, the simplest explanation here is that this is a job that would have gone to an American-born worker had it not been for the foreign. But it turns out that when you look at the data very, very carefully, the story is not that simple.
I guess I'm wondering if you talk about the economy as a whole, what do we see as the impact of this increasing number of immigrants coming over the course of the last couple decades?
So one of the mistakes we're making in, you know, when people think about the adverse effects of immigration is that if you think that there's some kind of a fixed number of jobs in the United States economy, and whenever an immigrant comes in, they take up some of those jobs, then of course you're going to see negative effects. But that's a very strange or unsophisticated way to think about the world. There isn't a fixed number of jobs. And so the way to think about, you know, how jobs are changing is that if there are immigrant workers who are lowering the cost of operating the business, that actually creates an opportunity for entrepreneurs to hire more Americans to be client-facing.
I want to go into the idea of the rate of immigration and the overall numbers. If it's true that we don't have a magic number of jobs in the U.S., we probably need, though, to arrive at some sort of a baseline for what we might set as a target. Is there a way to calculate how much immigration over how many years is going to make the inputs into the economy such that we can be sustained and growing? What is the tipping point at which too much immigration is too much?
I know. I think the short answer to that is no. There is no magic formula. It's just that if any number we get, it's probably not going to be credible. And let me try to explain some of that complexity. So we were talking about very simple jobs. It depends on, I'm going to use an economics term, elasticities. So it depends on, you know, when an immigrant worker comes in, how much cheaper is the operation of the business, and therefore how many more workers can this person hire relative to how many jobs are being lost because, you know, there's some fixed constraints on the number of jobs that are created. So that itself is complex, right? But it gets even more complex beyond that because the effect of immigration is not just in taking versus creating jobs. It's also about innovation. It turns out immigrants are one of the most important contributors to innovation in the United States, right? And innovation is the sector that we do really well in. So the U.S. economy, the U.S. does have a trade deficit in virtually every sector. And now, if you think about where the trade deficit is narrowest, right, it's most closest to a surplus, it's in high-tech sectors. So the U.S. economy specializes in high-tech. It specializes in the creation of new markets, new products, and that's how jobs get created.
So is there some kernel, though, in that, an argument for the merit-based immigration system that some propose that say, if we bring people here who are innovators with certain job skills, we won't be displacing or driving down the wages of lower-skilled workers, but we will be bringing in people who can contribute economically at the highest possible level to keep America on that trajectory that we believe that we're on.
Do we think that government bureaucrats sitting at USCIS, that they're the best at identifying talent and innovators? Probably not, right? America has a big family-based immigration policy. So, which is that, you know, apart from these H-1B visas, which is companies hiring people and then sponsoring them for visas, there's also American citizens who can sponsor their relatives to come to the U.S. Now, is that a problem? No, look, American citizens who are bringing other people in, when they bring other people in, and I've had to do this myself, they are taking responsibility, financial responsibility for those people. American citizens, by and large, are sensible. They're only going to take responsibility for a set of people who they want to bring in and think that this is a good idea. And I think leaving it up to U.S. citizens about who they want to bring in, there's a lot to be said for that rather than leaving it up to government bureaucrats. I wouldn't bring my loser cousin in because, you know, I'm going to have to pay for that for many, many years if I do.
I, I want to bring up our next guest, someone who's involved in the process of welcoming in people into the country. Will Kinnearum is Director of Employment and Education Services at Integrated Refugee and Immigrant Services in New Haven. Will, maybe you can talk a little bit about the work that you do at IRIS, first of all, just to give us a grounding in your work.
Absolutely. So we are a refugee resettlement organization here in New Haven, Connecticut. Just so you have some idea of the numbers, there are 65 million refugees in the world. 22 million of them have been given refugee status by the United Nations, and fewer than 1% of that group have been resettled each year for the last number of years. So America's been bringing anywhere from 60 to 100,000 refugees, and our current president set the number at a record low of 45,000 for this fiscal year, but it looks like we'll have fewer than 20,000. So this affects every organization across the country. At IRIS here in New Haven, we resettle special immigrant visa holders. We see the effect it has on the economy and our society every day. Statistically and anecdotally, the answer to whether immigration is good for the U.S. economy is an unequivocal yes.
I want to turn to Shannon Dooling. She's a reporter for WBUR in Boston. She's been working with me for the last couple of years on the New England News Collaborative on this project called Facing Change. And one of the things that you've followed is not just individuals who are here who have some, you know, very harrowing personal stories that we've heard at some great length through our reporting, but also families that have mixed immigration status and how difficult that can be.
Yeah, so it's often referred to as mixed status households. They are very common. The family that we're thinking about right now, I'll give you their sort of portfolio. The mother and father fled from Guatemala. The four sons of these two people. Three of them are U.S.-born citizens. One of them is not. He came to the country without authorization to meet up with his mom and dad. Isidro Macario is the eldest. He was born in Guatemala. And in February, he was deported back to Guatemala. I was there at the airport at Logan International at 6 in the morning. You know, literally, regardless of where you stand on policy, you're watching siblings being separated and not knowing when or how or if they're going to reunite. So let's hear from Isidro. He talks here a little bit about what living in a mixed status household has meant for him.
You know, it's very tough for myself and also for my family because you know, we've been struggling with this for so many years, and instead of getting better, it keeps getting worse and worse and worse, and nobody understands probably our pain.
That was a hard story to witness.
There is an economic imperative to this as well, and you got at it before, and it has to do with what this has done to these young men. Can you talk about that and how this relates to our conversation about the economy?
I think what my takeaway is that, so the three youngest brothers, all U.S. citizens, U.S.-born citizens, the 21-year-old had sort of accepted the fact that he was now going to be the primary breadwinner for his family of three. He said, I'll pick up, you know, a couple extra shifts. I'm going to try to do my best to be the father figure. The 18-year-old was going to pick up some extra shifts at McDonald's in a Boston suburb and also, you know, try to make it through his senior year of high school. And the 16-year-old didn't want to talk at all. It was kind of like if he wasn't talking about it, it wasn't happening. The 18-year-old and 16-year-old have failed out of high school. The 21-year-old is trying to sort of keep it all together. So here we have three U.S.-born citizens, and according to politics and policy, we've made a very clear line to differentiate them from their brother. And we've not given them much hope or motivation to become productive members of our community or our society. It's really all they can do to just kind of keep it together and be there for one another. So I'll let you maybe do the calculations as to what that might mean for economic productivity. But to me, it means we have some disenfranchised and isolated citizens that are going to be part of a whole new generation.
Mm. Well, let's talk about the two pieces of that. So there's policy that may change and may limit the number of people to enter the United States. But then there's that overwhelming worry that people have about whether or not America is a welcoming place for immigrants. Talk about that impact and what you see coming down the pike.
So I think the most lasting damage that I'm very worried about this country is that if this current administration is successful in relaying to the world that this is not a welcoming place for you. And then what happens is that, as I was saying earlier, why we have succeeded over the last many decades or centuries is that we have been the most welcoming place for talented people, a lot of talented people, initially from Europe and then from other parts of the world, all agglomerated here, and this country became successful. If somehow, you know, we now start conveying the message that we don't want you, this is not a place for you, then a lot of those talented people are going to end up somewhere else. And that's going to not show up immediately, but it's going to show up as 20 years down the road with less innovation happening. So if the next Google doesn't get started in the United States and instead it gets started in Germany or in Australia, that's going to be the big cost for us. And that's the lasting damage that we should all be really, really worried about.